Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we, of course, ask you to hold your calls for 15 to 20 minutes. We have with us this evening Dr. David Lohr, who's a Universalist Unitarian minister, but he's written a fascinating treatise on something called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Force, and Resources for a New Century. And his treatise on this think tank, a plan for the America to dominate the world militarily, I think is so important that I really, of course, wanted to have him on this evening to discuss this. You know, we've talked many, many times before about the fact that there is a plan. It's a very real plan. It has been in force for many years, but it is coming to a culmination now, and that is to use the military and financial power of the United States to bring the whole world into a one-world government, a new world order, and a one-world religion. Dr. Lohr, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, now, of course, you have written a treatise entitled Oil, Arrogance, and War, and, of course, you refer a great deal to this think tank, Rebuilding America's Defenses, and we see William Crystal there and a few other of the usual suspects.
Usual suspects, yes.
So I'm going to let you sort of pick up and just talk and tell us your thoughts, why you were concerned enough to write this treatise, and, of course, to get it out on the web and to try to awaken the American people.
Okay, there are a lot of areas this goes into, so let me start talking about some, and if it's going too far somewhere, just cut me off and redirect me, all right?
All right, don't you worry.
I think that a lot of forces have come into confluence, and we have to be able to look at a lot of dimensions of what's going on, because they are really now working in concert in a way that they haven't been up until now, and that's what makes the New World Order a reality. One of the forces is the one that you've mentioned that's laid out in that September 2000 paper, that 80-page paper that you and I both downloaded from the Internet and read. And in its own way, it's really quite an articulate and quite a stunning paper. It pulls almost no punches. It uses a few coded phrases, but not very many. And the gist of what the plan is, to understand the gist of what the plan is, we need to go back to 1989, when communism fell. And what people in this country, especially in the right wing of the country, began seeing then, and I'm not knocking this, or at least I don't want to dismiss it. I think this is a powerful argument that those of us who don't like it need to be able to counter. What they saw then was that where for the last 40 years of the Cold War, there had been two superpowers who had this mutually assured destruction plan of balancing the powers, now there was only one superpower. And what the people in the right wing saw was that this was a once-in-a-lifetime chance for America to rewrite the rules of the world, because there was no country with the power to oppose us by itself. The restructuring of the world was going to be a restructuring that favored what they called, American principles, American interests. These are the few code phrases that are in that paper. But what American principles and American interests means was not democracy. I mean, we don't really want democratically elected governments if that means those governments will reflect the will of the majority of their citizens. We've routinely backed tyrants and dictators who replaced democratically elected officials. What American principles and interests mean are the economic interests of the people who control the major corporations and the major money in America. And I think, again, they can make a strong argument for this. They can say, look, someone's going to write the rules that run the economy of the world. Now's the time when we can do it, and we would be both fools and cowards if we didn't take the opportunity to do it. That's what's driving the dream of the New World Order. And this military plan that they came out with, as they said in the plan, it's really a fleshing out of the plan that then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney had drafted in the waning days of the first Bush administration in 1991-92. It's quite a brilliant plan. The gist of it is that we have to have a military force capable of world domination. You know, it's hard saying that phrase, world domination, because when you hear it, you want to laugh, and you think this is some kind of a wacko conspiracy theory that uses words like that. But it really does mean being able to write the rules that dictate the economic rules that the major world economies will play by, and to do that under the threat or the presence of military force. The reason military force is necessary, and this is where all these parts of the picture start interlocking, because they're all essential parts of it. The reason force is necessary, because what the New World Order is doing is what we've seen happen in this country for the last 22 years. It's the systematic and intentional transfer of wealth and power and possibility from the lower 90 or 95% of the population to the top, especially 1%. And the reason you need force to do that, although we also use propaganda, another word that's hard to use without making people's antenna go up, is because no free people are really willing to work harder for less to benefit so few people. So the military might and threat of the military might to guarantee the economic rules that we want is essential. And this is a paper that lays it out really very well. Some of the things that it says that are shocking, and I think there's a smoking gun in it of some kind. It talks about being able to fight and win simultaneous major theater wars. I mean, these are frightening terms, but they're used very casually in the paper. Let's see, major theater wars. What are the other pieces? Now I'm trying to get the order straight on this. And it talks about restructuring this. It talks about the military presence in the Gulf. And it says in September of 2000, when this paper was written, before the current Bush administration took power, that we regard our military presence in the Persian Gulf region as permanent, while we're going to keep trying to convince the Saudis and Kuwaitis and so forth that we're benign. And it says that we need to replace Saddam Hussein with essentially a puppet dictatorship, and that the current problems with the man Saddam offer the rationale for doing this now. This is September 2000, but that this is something we need to do anyway because we want a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf. We want the rules for oil and the rules for the control of oil and power to be written in ways that favor American interests. At the end of laying out all this very detailed military stuff, and there may be parts of it that you read in the paper that you want to lift up too, it has a very, very interesting paragraph. It says kind of sadly that even if we had the will to do this, and it would take military expenditure of nearly 4% of gross national product, which I think is about where we are now, that even if we had the will to do it, they said that it would take a long time for this revolution to take place. And then they added this curious phrase. They said it would take a long time unless there were a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. And that's a phrase that keeps coming back to haunt as we approach September 11th and see how the September 11th events were treated. Now that's sort of part one of this, and I can talk about September 11th or talk about terrorism or economics or go where you'd like to go or stop and let you get some words in.
Well, let's see. I'm going to let you talk for a while, and then we can. I want to get your thoughts on this, and then I can to give you my thoughts, and we can ask some of the. Let's get your thoughts on what happened on September 11th. Certainly. Yes. We find a devastating event, almost a watershed event for America. The American people were psychologically devastated.
Absolutely.
I shall never forget sitting there that morning watching the smoke billowing from the Twin Towers, of course, with Tom Brokaw's face in front of that, looking very, very grave. And it really was, as I watched for a day or so, it was not, pretty soon I began to realize that they were using music and they were using pictures of weeping faces and dust-stained faces, streaked with tears. They were manipulating my emotions. It was done very, very cleverly. It was done almost as if somebody was orchestrating everything we saw on television.
Yes.
And you suddenly then begin to realize maybe there was something here entirely different than we were actually seeing. In other words, what we were seeing on the screen had taken place, somebody had planned exactly how they were going to use this to transform America forever. Now, what's your take on that?
That's very nice. Let's go back and let me talk a little bit about economics and then approach September 11th from a very different direction than we've seen it approached in the press. The targets selected on September 11th were highly symbolic targets, and that's a point that always needed to be stressed, but that seldom was. They picked the targets of America's economic dominance and of America's military dominance in the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon. I want to go back 81 years before September 11th to September of 1921. That, as some have said, was the last time the American economy was as out of balance as it is now, when the economy favored the ultra-rich at the expense of everyone else to the extent that it does now. And that's something that triggers anger. In 1921, it triggered anger among our own citizens. What happened in September 16th, 1921, was that terrorists, and it's the word the historical accounts have used for it, they happened to be American terrorists, exploded dynamite outside of the offices of J.P. Morgan. They killed 34 people and they wounded over 200. That was a terrorist attack on a building symbolic of economic arrogance in 1921. That's why the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon were attacked on September 11th of 2001. It was an attack on things that the murderers, and I'm not justifying the people who attacked, they were murderers, and they should be brought to international justice for this. But this is what the murderers on September 11th saw as signs of America's economic greed and arrogance and imperialism. And if we think that the economy in the United States is skewed, it's far worse in some of the other countries where we have been meddling. So the clever twist on September 11th, and I'm not minimizing this, but I want to be very careful about the words we use. What was attacked on September 11th, the victims on September 11th, was not America. The victims were 3,000 innocent people who happened to work in highly symbolic buildings. Those buildings were attacked as an outrageous and murderous expression of anger and hatred and frustration at what is perceived by many countries in the world as America's economic and military arrogance. What happened on September 12th, and it happened with breathtaking speed. It was done so well and so brilliantly. It was just breathtaking, I think, to me, and you described it that way too, was that the attack got completely reframed. The fact that the buildings were symbolic of economic and military arrogance was not really mentioned. Instead, it was framed as an attack on America, instead of on American economic and military policies. The enemy, instead of being called just the Taliban, because you can't justify an ongoing war forever if all you want to do is find and kill Osama bin Laden, which we haven't been able to do anyway.
Or maybe we didn't really try to do it.
We didn't try to do it, and no one seemed to notice when we stopped, which is interesting. But the enemy then was declared to be terrorism. It's brilliant and it's very interesting. What the word terrorism is doing then is taking the place of communism. Communism was an ideology that was sort of our abstract enemy for 40 years of the Cold War. But terrorism isn't an ideology, and it isn't a country, and it isn't a nationality. It's a military tactic. Communism isn't a tactic, it's an ideology. And you can't fight a tactic of terrorism. terrorism is a tactic that weak people use to attack strong people because you can never shut off all the defenses against it. I'm a veteran of the Vietnam War. I was in that war. I was a combat photographer in Vietnam and saw much of it and was in the middle of much of it. And I thought we learned then that you cannot defeat terrorism. You can never shut all the doors to terrorism. They can do it anytime, any place. It doesn't have to be an airplane into a building. It can be anything that can create terror. But what happened to the American people, and it happened brilliantly, was that terrorism was defined as the enemy, the way communism was. The American flag was wrapped around it, and it was defined as an act of war that justified us going into a nearly permanent and unending war state, to listen to some of President Bush's rhetoric, until terrorism is wiped out all over the world. It isn't possible to do that unless you are such a big bully that no one can ever scare you anywhere. So somewhere around here is where, in my opinion, it crosses over into the insane.
Well, of course, I think that people have to realize that there has to be a state behind any sort of a well-organized terrorist activity. You maybe have one or two isolated terrorists committing burning something down, or maybe getting some explosives and blowing things up. But to do something of this magnitude, you need a lot of planning. But more than that, you need a lot of money.
Sure.
And, of course, there was a great deal of help that was given to these people. For instance, 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia.
Right.
None of them should have been allowed in this country because none of them filled out their visa forms properly. They're supposed to say where they're going to be staying, what they're going to be doing. We have rules and regulations, but the Central Intelligence Agency, which dominates the offices over there in Saudi Arabia, saw to it that all these men were allowed to come into this country in violation of our laws. Why would they do something that stupid? And yet, of course, we've talked to Michael Springman, who was actually worked there in the Saudi embassies in Saudi Arabia, and he talked about how he was put under pressure by the CIA to bring in people who never should have been allowed to come into this country, people who are coming here for terrorist training and terrorist activities. And of course, why would we allow these people to come in? Why would we have a couple of people coming in from Malaysia who are, of course, known to be terrorists, involved in terrorism? And they're living with a CIA, pardon me, an FBI informant in San Diego, and the FBI can't find them. I mean, one of them has his name listed in the telephone book, and the FBI can't find him. And we have terrorist lists at every airport. And, of course, several of my friends have been on this so-called terrorist list. And when they report to, get on the airplane, where they're taken to special places and searched and given very, very special treatment. And when my friend Barrett Sos, who is a kindly old I shouldn't say old grandmother, she's a kindly grandmother, but, when she asked, what are you looking for? She was told, we can't tell you because, of course, we don't want the terrorists to know. Now, this woman is a born-again Christian. They did this repeatedly until, of course, we put her on the radio and announced what they were doing. And then, of course, they backed away from this. And I do the same thing with my friend Dave Wagner. His crime is he's a patriot. He loves America. And he writes about the establishment. But he is on the terrorist white list. Isn't it interesting that none of the terrorists who attacked our buildings were on the terrorist watch list, even the people that they knew were terrorists? And then, of course, those of people who have not yet read Christian Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on the 18th of September, and if you want a copy of that and you're out in the listening audience, I'll be glad to send it to you. It's our October newsletter. It was a brilliant piece of testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Christian's husband, Ron, died in the South Tower, and she just pointed out that the government said they had no idea the attack was coming. They had no idea who these people were, but within 2 hours of the attack, and she quotes from the New York Times, within 2 hours of the attack, the FBI was in the areas where the terrorists ate, where their flight schools they attended, the neighborhoods where they lived. And she said, if they had no idea it was coming and they knew had no idea who they were, how could they be there within 2 hours? And she said the answer should be obvious. Maybe that's why, of course, the mass media didn't pick up Christian Breitweiser's testimony, but it is available either up on the net or we provide it for our listeners. If you just give us a call and ask for the October newsletter at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. So I think, Dr. Lohr, you and I would tend to agree that, there's something very wrong with what happened on the 11th of September, and perhaps things were not quite as we anticipated, or we might, the average person perceived. Would you say that would be a fair statement?
I would. I like all the information that you just gave. I want to add something to this. That ominous sentence in the September 2000 80-page position paper, that what it would take to restructure the military to do this new world order would take a long time unless there were a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor.
Do you know what page that was on?
Oh, no. I wish you hadn't
all
asked
right. me All
that.
Right, fine. I won't ask you that. That question is withdrawn.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. I mean, it's hard to have that whole thing. You did a very, very good job in your treatise really of outlining so much of what was in there. But there's so many fascinating things, you know. As you read this, you have the feeling that everything is cut and dried. Back in 1990, they were planning on a second Gulf War.
That's right. It's. I will find the page. I actually think it's around page 61 or 62. Here it is, page 51.
All right, fine.
And the quote is, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing events like a new Pearl Harbor.
Like a new Pearl Harbor, right, and it's
and
right
what,
there.
What is most interesting, and I read this first, and I was surprised because I'd never heard of this. I read this first from a German correspondent just weeks after 9/11, who said that Pearl Harbor isn't the historical precedent for this. The historical precedent that we need to look to is the Reichstag fire. I'd never heard of the Reichstag fire, and so I went online to research it, and many of your listeners haven't heard of it. This is some stunning stuff. Now, we're in an area where I know some people are suggesting that the government may have planned this, and I don't know that. I want to stop short of asserting it because I wouldn't know how to prove it, but I do want to talk about how the government used the opportunity once it happened, because that was brilliant. The Reichstag fire is something I think Americans need to know about. Here's the very brief story. On January 29th, 1933, Hitler was elected, although his party was a minority. They didn't have a majority. There was going to be an election coming up in another 6 weeks or so. 4 weeks after that, on February 27th, 1933, the Reichstag was lit afire in Berlin. The Reichstag was a government building. Hitler really never liked it. Historians still argue over who lit the fire. There was a deranged man claiming to be a communist who was arrested and later beheaded for lighting the fire. Other historians think that Hitler's people lit it. I don't know. I don't know if anyone will ever know. But what Hitler did with it was sheer brilliance. The very next day, February 28th, Hitler and President Hindenburg suspended virtually all civil liberties in the name of national security. They declared that this was an attack on Germany by communism instead of either one deranged man or some of Hitler's squad that did this. 4,000 communists were arrested that night, and I believe 40,000 of Hitler's political opponents were arrested within the next 2 weeks. That really made the upcoming election null and void. German democracy, such as it was canceled, and the rest, as we know, was history. The catastrophic and catalyzing event of 9/11 was treated by the administration, and I'm not saying they caused any of it. I don't know that. But it was treated by this administration the same way that the German administration treated the Reichstag fire in 1933. And to me, A, that's chilling, and B, it's distressing that Americans haven't been told this story.
Well, I think, of course, the most significant thing was the fact that within 46 days of the attack, why the USA Patriot Act had become law. Now, you have to understand that this was a law that the many provisions in that Bill Clinton had tried to get through in 1995 after the bombing of the Murrah building, and Congress would not pass this legislation. And so, they got this thing through. They wrote this thing up, and many people suspect that actually the legislation was written long before the attack. I can't say that to be a fact, but I think it is amazing that they were able to get it through both houses of Congress. Ordinarily, legislation takes a long time. You saw how long it took to get the Office of Homeland Security legislation through. But what was so interesting is, of course, the anthrax attack comes. Members of Congress are terrified. They have this acronym, USA Patriot. Who can be against the USA Patriot Act? And, of course, if you read what the USA, what that stands for, it's the most absurd thing you ever saw. But what they're doing is playing games. They put a name on this. They should be called not the USA Patriot Act, but the USA Unpatriot Act, because it essentially suspends the Fourth Amendment. It really does away with the entire basis of our Constitution. It allows secret searches of people's homes. It has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. There's not one word in there about Islamic terrorism. They simply redefine the word terrorism.
Right.
And, of course, it is so broad. Anybody who wants to change our form of government by coercion, well, that obviously refers to people like William Kristol, who's writing this treatise, or the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, or the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, whose loyalty is not to America, but to this world system, who believe in free trade and who believe in tearing down our tariff barriers, who believe in transferring America's wealth to third world nations. And, of course, at least the only wealth they're not going to transfer is the wealth of the very, very wealthy. They're going to take the wealth of the middle class and really create a class of society. There'll be a ruling class, and everybody else will be the same, as I see this thing unfolding. But
I agree.
The great, great tragedy of today is that the average American doesn't understand that the government used the tragedy of the death of 3,000 people to get through legislation they wanted, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, the USA Patriot Act, and now, of course, the Office of Homeland Security. Now, of course, you had commented earlier about how difficult it was for anybody to stop terrorism. In other words, certainly if there are people there who hate America, they could commit all sorts of acts of terrorism. You wouldn't be able to stop them. The most amazing thing is, that has been over a year, almost not quite a year and a half, since the September 11th attack. And we've had no other major attacks of terrorism except for the anthrax attack. And, of course, the government knew that was coming, at least the White House did, because the very evening of September 11th, why Dick Cheney and George Bush and the White House staff were put on Cipro, they didn't tell anybody about it. They didn't tell give other people the opportunity to go on to antibiotics. In fact, they didn't even bother to close down many of the post offices they knew were contaminated, that where people were subsequently infected. How did the administration know that there might be an attack, or that there was going to be an attack? And, of course, we know now, of course, that the anthrax was from our own military laboratories. The person who did the attack had to have been vaccinated many months ahead of time. So whatever happened was long-term planning, but I don't think it was planned by Osama bin Laden over there in a cave in Afghanistan. So there's something very wrong with what's going on in America today. The great tragedy is the administration, and I agree with Dr. Lohr, they are using this to restrict our freedom. And, of course, as we move towards this new world order and new world religion, and I am seriously concerned that, we are going to antagonize the entire Muslim world. In fact, really the whole world. Our contacts over in Europe tell us nobody in Europe wants a war. Contacts 2 days ago in London said nobody in Great Britain wants the war. Even the Queen is speaking against it. There are only two people I know who really want this war, maybe three, Dick Cheney, George Bush, and Tony Blair. And maybe there are a few people out there who are going along with this because it's the way to go. But they're all establishment. They're dedicated to the ruling elite's concepts of the New World Order and the New World Religion. I wonder how many people on our listening audience tonight really believe that we should go to war with Iraq. Not that anybody, I think, has any support for Saddam Hussein. But remember, we left him in power in 91, and we kept him in power in 1995 when the Iraqi military wanted to get him out. And we'll tell you how we can document that a little bit later. Right now, we're going to take a break. And when we get back, we'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours a day talking to people across America, hoping that some of them will listen. They may not agree, but maybe they'll start thinking. Maybe they'll check the sources of reference that we use, and maybe they'll try to get the books we talk about or the videos of the audio tapes, and then go into the historical records that go up on the Internet or perhaps pull down this document we're talking about today. This evening, it's called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and we'll give you the website where you can get that a little later in the program. But, what a unique opportunity to reach people. There is a spiritual blindness, I believe, that is keeping people from seeing the truth, but I personally believe the only way to reach them today is by radio, and so this is why I do what I do. But believe me, it's expensive, 5 hours a day on radio, 5 hours a day on the Internet, 3 hours a day on satellite, 2 hours a day on the shortwave, and then, of course, we have our weekend programs. We have one on Saturday, and then we have a half-hour program that goes to 36 stations on Saturday. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, why, we would ask you to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, October newsletter, Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, December newsletter really goes into the occult foundation of our monetary system. And if you wonder what I'm talking about, why, you need to get the December newsletter. But I think that our newsletters are all up there on the Internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And we invite you to go there and to pull down the newsletters, and hopefully we can challenge everything you believe. The newsletters are all well documented. We have every reference that's there, and if you want any of them, you can always call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we'll provide them for you free of charge. We want you to get the facts. We want you to be able to present the facts and help us convince others truly about the very real problems we face today. So again, remember our website, radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Dr. David Lohr, and of course, he's a minister. And we were just talking before we went to the break, and I just want to make this one point, that we went for almost a year and a half without a terrorist attack in America. Now, other than the anthrax attack, which obviously somebody in the administration suspected was going to come, because they put the White House staff and the president and vice president on Cipro, but they didn't warn the rest of us. Gee, I wonder why that was. Well, anyway, but the significant thing I was really trying to bring out is, how could it be, if we had all these terrorists in America, there were no other terrorist attacks? Well, you'll have to remember that within, we had no idea the attack was. We had no idea who the terrorists were. We had no idea what anything was going to happen. We thought everything was going to happen overseas, and we weren't monitoring the Islamic terrorists in America. But within 2 or 3 days, we'd arrested over 1,200 people, and some of them are still in custody today. And I'd like to suggest to you, of course, the government will tell you how they decided who they were going to arrest and who these people were, and a lot of them, they wouldn't give their names out where they were being held, and they couldn't see any lawyers. If they were here illegally on immigration charges, why not send them out? No, I think that a lot of these people were terrorists. They've known who the terrorists were. They've been monitoring them all along, but they couldn't very well tell the American people that. They couldn't very well tell the American people that two of the terrorists who crashed into the World Trade Center were living with an FBI informant, or the FBI had informants all throughout this whole Islamic terrorist movement. And so, of course, they had to make you think that they just happened to pick these people up just spontaneously off the streets. The FBI was so astute, they arrested 1,200 people, and there have been no further terrorist attacks. And if you believe that happened by accident, no. We have a very effective intelligence organizations. We have satellites that watch people. They open your mail. They listen to your email. They listen to your telephone calls. We knew exactly much of what was going on. We knew who the terrorists were and the terrorist cells. And the reason I believe we haven't had any terrorist attacks is because we arrested most of the terrorists, or probably almost all the terrorists, and of course we're still holding some of them completely incommunicado, 100 and 150, something like that at the present time, but we still won't tell anybody who they are. So, Dr. Lohr, of course, do you have a website or place where people can get your information?
We have a church website, and it's a very short address, www.austinuu.org.
AustinUU.org. Okay.
AustinUU.org.
All right. Is the website up there where people can pull down this document?
I don't have that 80-page paper on our website. I do have the Sermon on Oil, Arrogance, and War that you talked about, and it's on the website, and all the information on the document is in it.
And, of course, the website is there, too. That's how I was able to find the website.
Right.
And so it's well worthwhile pulling down and reading. Now, we will offer it to Radio Liberty for those who can't get it up there. It's really called The Rebuilding America's Defense Strategy, Force, and Resources for a New Century. And, of course, we'll have it bound. But you can certainly pull that down off the web if you'd like. It's a fascinating read because, of course, it was put out, before the September 11th attack. And yet, of course, a year before. And yet, of course, all this thing, in my estimation, was planned. Certainly the writings of if you haven't read the reports of the National Commission on Security in the 21st Century, of course, it put out over the name of Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. And you read their first report, 1999, September 99. They told you about all the terrorist attacks we were going to have in America. See, it's amazing they knew it, but the FBI had no idea. And we have that Phase 1 report and then the Phase 2 and 3 report. Phase 3 came out, I believe, in January of 2001. It talked about the Office of Homeland Security and how we were going to have to reorganize our government exactly as we have. It's almost as if, did you ever have a feeling, Dr. Lohr, that somebody's reading a script?
You have a gift for understatement. Yeah, it is. And it's scary to be able to say all the things you said and say, look, all this was known a year in advance, and then it was all put into effect. And one of the implications is that the war against Iraq, for instance, has absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. It never did. The Homeland Security Bill was not necessitated by 9/11. It was already planned. That what was coming in, and this is a phrase that we're seeing a lot, and I'm fear we're going to hear a lot more of, is what's called a command and control government. And the Homeland Security Force is part of a command and control government, and it has to be command and control because you can't disempower an entire society of people, economically, unless you can also control them through power.
Well, I think, of course, one very effective result of this war will be to cover what's going to happen economically. I think we're in real trouble economically, and I think we're moving into a very perilous position as far as the economy of the United States is concerned, contracting economy, factories operating at less than three-quarters capacity, layoffs, unemployment, office space opening. The real estate bubble is in the process of popping. Certainly the major stock market bubble has already popped, and it certainly would have gone down a great deal more if there hadn't been, I think, some artificial manipulation. But I think that, of course, we're going to see continued contraction of the economy. But then we can blame that on the wicked Saddam Hussein,
right.
Of course, not on our courageous leaders in both political parties who set this whole thing up. And if you actually see what they've done over the last 3 years, now, there's national debt, there's state debt, there's private debt, there's commercial debt, there's corporate debt. Then there's something the Federal Reserve puts out, it's called total debt. And we have the figures in my December newsletter, and anybody wants to see the figures, we have them all compiled. In the total debt for the United States is $31 trillion. Now, that's a lot of money. But within 3 years, that took us all since the beginning of America to get to that total debt of $31 trillion. In just 3 years, they increased that from 25.5 to $31 trillion. Now, what you're seeing is the most rapid expansion of debt in all recorded history. And even with all that expansion of debt, they couldn't keep this economy going. So they can pour in all the money they want to, and they know that it's not going to work. So somebody once said why the Federal Reserve is between a rock and a hard place, and that's sort of a pun, but I believe that Iraq is going to be used to justify the continuing difficult times ahead of us. Well, our telephone number, if you're out listening to us across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Lohr, and let me have you put out that website again, because the reference to the other website is there, and Dr. Lohr's article is well worthwhile reading. His comments are well worthwhile reading, and of course you can then go to the web and pull down the treatise on rebuilding America's defenses, put out a year before the attack, and yet, of course, it really foretells exactly what's going to happen if you read between the lines.
Yes, the website address is www.austinuu.org. The sermon title is Oil, Arrogance, and War, and you can find it under sermons, and then the report and its website information are there. I've written a short book on this that brings in other dimensions of it, that I'm trying to find a publisher for. So if you have anyone out there who's a publisher, contact me. I have it out with the readers now, but I'm trying to find a publisher for a 20,000-word book.
I see.
One other comment I want to make that I imagine will be incendiary, but I think that's part of what we're trying to do to get people's attention. The tactic, and again, it's brilliant, the tactic that the government is using is to control people by controlling the most powerful symbols that we have. They use the flag, they use the word God a lot, though I don't think they use the word God in ways that Jesus would have recognized. And they use that to numb people to the fact that they're absolutely being robbed blind, that their economic hopes and power are being taken away from them. And the sad and cruel irony of this is that I think that the people that are being duped the worst, and please understand, I don't mean this insultingly, but I think it's what's happening. I think the people who are being duped the worst are the evangelical and fundamentalist Christians who are being duped by the use of the word God, though it's hardly a godly way that we're acting, and by the waving of the flag, while their jobs, their security, and their standard of living is being taken away from them and drained. That, I think, is one of the cruelest of the crimes going on.
Well, now, of course, I happen to be evangelical Christian, but I tend to agree with your basic treatise. And what I see are evangelical leaders rallying behind the president in this effort to go after Saddam and using all these trite situations, slogans like, well, gee, we should have taken him out, in 1991, but now we got to finish the job. A little earlier I commented that we not only left him in power intentionally in 1991, but we left him in power again in 1995. And I would use as a source of reference for that a fascinating book called See No Evil by Robert Byrd, who was a CIA operative, and of course he was a senior CIA agent, station chief in northern Iraq in 1995. And his book, of course, was cleared by the CIA before it was published, so some things he couldn't very well say. He said everybody in Iraq, or many of the people in Iraq, believe that the CIA betrayed the Iraqi military leaders in 1993 who wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And again, of course, then he tells about when he was there in 1995, when we again betrayed the Iraqi military officers who wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. So if you read the book, it's quite obvious that there was an effort to overthrow Saddam in 1993 by the Iraqi military, again in 1995 by the Iraqi military. And both times, the CIA and our government left him in power. Now, you wonder, why would we do that? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense unless, of course, nothing is as it appears to be today. In fact, I was so almost ironical. I was reading an article today in the paper, and it said, you know, our leaders are just hoping the Iraqi people overthrow Saddam Hussein. The ideal solution would be one bullet in the end of Saddam. Well, it all sounds very, very good, but of course there are many people, and according to Robert Byrd, there are many of the Iraqi people who think, and I'm not suggesting this is true at all, But many of the Iraqi people think that Saddam is a CIA operative. Now, I think that that may be a little far-fetched, but why would the Iraqi people feel that way? Because they know that we put him in power, we financed him during the 1980s, we financed him right up until the attack on Kuwait, we left him in power, and then, of course, we've done everything we could to discourage efforts to overthrow him. So nothing is as it appears to be, and I would like to suggest that people have got to begin thinking and questioning everything. And only then, of course, can we think outside of the controlled media, which is manipulating our emotions and really has the ability to control what the American people think.
I'd like to add my own rant on that one. I think that for the media to be doing their job, the media are called the fourth estate, and it's an essential part of a democracy. You can't have a democracy if the people aren't informed, and that's part of what the fourth estate is supposed to be doing, keep the people informed. And to see the media lapse into not only sensationalism, but sensationalism meant as a tactic of distraction for the public to keep them ignorant, in my fantasy world, the media superstars would be tried for treason. That's never going to happen. But I think it's a first-rate betrayal of democracy to have the media be so silent and complacent on this.
Well, I like to refer to the fourth estate as having become a fifth column. Because I believe that they really are betraying the interests of this country. Because I don't mean that all the reporters are bad. I think that many good reporters out there, and I've talked to them, and they write the articles, and somebody who works for the people who own the newspaper either spike the article or simply alter it, rewrite it, something many times that the reporter wants to get the story out. He's told how to write the article. He's told the slant to put on it, because the people who seem to own the media seem to have their own agenda, which, of course, is not necessarily one dedicated to the sovereignty of America, but dedicated more to this idea of this unifying all the peoples of the world and under this one world system. But of course, the one world system will not be a universal democracy. It will be a ruling elite who will control the world. And it really is a takeoff on what Plato had described in his Republic, almost 370 years before.
And his laws, really. Yep.
Right. And I think that the average individual, since the average individual has been so dumbed down he couldn't even read Plato, the average individual really doesn't understand that everything we're seeing has been predicted long ago.
Yes. And Machiavelli is in a lot of the footnotes for what's going on. The whole New World Order is Machiavelli. And then, you know, it doesn't do any good to take cheap shots at him. Machiavelli was the one who was essentially saying, look, the idea of ruling is to control people. Here are a lot of clever ways to do it so you can think smart. And it's what clever governments use, and we're using them. But it's still distressing to see the people kept so happily ignorant of it. And some of it, I think, is because the big lie is the hardest one to disprove. We simply don't want to believe, and I don't either. We simply don't want to believe that the president is lying to us in a bold-faced way, that his administration is lying, that all these plans were in effect before September 11th, but all the things that I've read lead me to believe that those things are absolutely true. That's devastating.
Well, of course, it's just sort of like when you find out there is no Santa Claus. Why? It totally crushes you. But the reality is that things are not as we appear to be. I love America, and I've dedicated the last 40 years of my life to trying to preserve it. But of course, the America I love is not the America we have today. The America I love is the one where, of course, there were restrictions placed on the power of the central authority, where a small group of wealthy men did not control the leadership of both political parties, and, of course, utilized the financial and military power of the United States to pursue their own aggrandizement. It's only when you study history and you begin to find the truth about the wars of the last century. And then, of course, you wonder, once you understand that they've all been manipulated, the Boer War, the Spanish-American War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, the First Gulf War. And now we're about to enter a Second Gulf War. And I'd like your opinion. I mean, I read the polls this weekend. 82 or 83% of the people supposedly support the president going to war if he has the backing of the United Nations and of course, of our European allies.
I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either.
I don't believe it.
All right. Well, as I read that, I said, either I'm crazy or these people are lying.
It seems unlikely that everyone we know is in the 18% of the country. There are two things when we talk about the Gulf War, and this is kind of on the big lie thing again. There are two huge hoaxes that got us into the first Gulf War, and I'm betting more than 99% of Americans still don't know about them. One was, and I got involved in this because I couldn't believe it when I saw it. In the Gulf War, the first one was 1991, January 15th. In December 1990, I believe it was the December 3rd issue of Newsweek of 1990, inside the front cover, they had these little one-paragraph story leads, and one of them said, "Where are the troops?" Now, this is after we've been told that there are 200,000 or 300,000 troops in Kuwait that have come in from Iraq and so forth. And it said that satellite photos had been bought, taken in, I believe, August and November, that had been interpreted by a retired CIA guy and someone else who's interpreted satellite photos, and they found two things. They found that in August, the one highway going into Kuwait from Iraq had a sand dune drifting over about two-thirds of it at one point, and at that same point in October or November, but well after there were supposedly 200,000 or 300,000 troops, the same sand dune covered the highway completely. No vehicles had driven down that highway during that time. I called Newsweek about this to ask what the story was and who was working on it and where the data was. It was put on hold. The operator came back and said, that story's over and we thank you for your interest in Newsweek, and hung up. On January 6th in the St. Petersburg, Florida newspaper, I forget the name of that paper, those photos were published on the front page of the paper, January 6th, 1991. To my knowledge, once war was declared 9 days later, no paper in America published them again for the rest of the year. At the end of the year, the Columbia Journalism Review reported that as one of the 10 most underreported stories of the year. That's a hoax that people still don't know about. The second one was more brazen and amazing. I saw it on television, maybe you did, maybe many people did. The vote to do the first Gulf War passed by only 5 votes. It was taken after the heart-rending testimony of Naida, this 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl, who testified that she'd been in the hospitals in Kuwait when Iraqi soldiers came in and they bayoneted babies and they threw them out on the floor and killed them. I mean, it's horrible, horrible testimony. After the vote, at least 6 of our congressmen said that they were going to vote against the war until Naida's testimony. They changed their vote to yes because of her testimony. We know that her entire testimony was a fiction. Naida was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. The story was written and rehearsed by the Hill and Knowlton public relations firm that Kuwait had hired for either $5 or $10 million to persuade Congress to send American soldiers almost as mercenaries into Kuwait. 99% of Americans still don't know this, and the details of the story are very easy to find. That's stunning.
Yes, well, there's just so many things. Of course, one of the biggest frauds was the fact that our ambassador to Saudi Arabia took pictures of the satellite pictures of the Iraqi troops massed on the Saudi Arabian border, and of course convinced that the Saudis, that the Saddam was about to attack them. Now, the satellite pictures were totally fraudulent. There were no troops massed on the Saudi border at all. Saddam Hussein never had any intention of attacking Saudi Arabia. We simply lied to the Saudis so we could station our people there and put our planes on Saudi Arabian soil. And of course, it was that fact, it was that action that antagonized so many of the Muslims, the Islamic fundamentalists, because this was then the Crusaders having returned to the land of Mecca and Medina.
That's right.
And of course, people don't understand the significance. Our leaders understood exactly what they were doing. It's sort of like poking a stick at a rattlesnake. I mean, you can't keep poking a stick at a rattlesnake without eventually him striking back. And the fanaticism of radical Islam was exploited tragically. We lied to the Saudis. We lied to the American people. And the whole idea was Saddam was going to take Kuwait, and he was going to take Saudi Arabia, and he was going to take, you know, and then he was going to take Europe, and, you know, and it's sort of the same thing with
the domino theory.
Right. And it was all a lie. But,
right.
You know, it justified the war. It justified murdering 100,000 Iraqis. And then, of course, after the war, another 1.5 million Iraqis, and 500,000 Iraqi children died because we put an embargo on. And men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And because the good people in America didn't speak out, and because the church didn't speak out, and, of course, the silence was deafening. Why, of course, they got away with it. And now, of course, we're going to have another war. And we will keep having wars until people understand that these wars are all created and manipulated. And of course, when are the good people going to take a stand? When is the Christian church, the evangelical church that Dr. Laura is speaking of, when is it going to take a stand for righteousness and saying, oh, well, we've got to go along. Doesn't matter if the president said it, why, we've got to go along because God put him there. Well, I'd like to suggest maybe it was the other side of the religious spectrum that put him there. I thought the God that we were. So we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners here?
one historical note that comes from the history of Christianity that should be sobering on terrorism. In the second century, the Christians were being persecuted and slaughtered in great numbers, fed to the lions and burned and so on and so forth. And some observers were afraid that all the martyrdoms, all the Christian martyrdoms, were going to wipe the religion out. And a Christian theologian named Tertullian, writing at the end of the second century, said something that ought to just send chills up our back. He said, no, that isn't going to happen. And his quote was, the blood of martyrs is seed. When people are willing to die for something, and now I'm talking about the terrorists who are willing to die for the fanatical beliefs that made them crash planes into the World Trade Center and so forth. When people are willing to die for a belief, to protest bullying and outrageous injustice, it's like seed, and it creates more people willing to die for a belief. Our treatment of bombing Afghanistan and invading Iraq is guaranteed, and the history of Christianity even shows this, is guaranteed to increase the number of people willing to be terrorists against America. I just think it is insane at every level.
Well, I think how many Christians are willing to die for their beliefs today? And, of course, as Whitaker Chambers said of Alger Hiss, I could never hate a man who agreed with me that that life is not worth living for which you're not willing to die at any moment.
Right.
The Muslims are willing to die for their belief. How many Christians are willing to die for theirs? Thank you so much, Dr. Laura. We're out of time. God bless you. Appreciate you being with us this evening.
Thank you very much, sir.
Good night. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll have to bid goodbye to our listeners up in the great Northwest. And we'll be back with you again tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We're hoping to have Randy Thomason on from the Campaign for California Families. And, of course, he's up there in Sacramento watching what's going on and reporting to us and other people across California. So they have an idea of what's happening in our state capital. Now, you have to understand that the wicked people take over when the good people aren't involved. And that's what's happened within the state of California. The people on the radical left, and there are lots of good liberals out there, sincere, idealistic people who we have a great deal of common with. But there are people who have an entirely different philosophy. They really believe in socialism. They believe in an all-powerful state, doing away with freedom, doing away with property rights. And, of course, they are committed to their belief. Of course, they're using the environmental issues to ever increase their control over every aspect of our lives, and eventually, of course, to sorely limit the Constitution, because their dedication, of course, is to the destruction of humanity as we know it. And, of course, creating a society where the grizzly bears and the wolves and the antelope will be out free and the people will be living in cages. And that's exactly what, of course, they were talking about last night when we had Joan Paris and Jeannie Sodeman here. And they openly brag. That's what it's really all about. The animals will roam free and the people will live in cages. Well, let's go to Randy Thomason and find out what's happening up in Sacramento. Hi, Randy. How you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Doing well. It's good to talk to you again here. And what is it now? The second week in January.
Right. Well, we're getting into it's the 14th today. So it's the end of the second week of January. And, of course, I want to find out what's happening in Sacramento. Of course, we hear Governor Davis talking about a $34.5 billion deficit. But I've talked to Senator Ray Haynes, or at least I've talked to his office and read the material. And he said the governor just is not being completely forthright. He's exaggerating the degree of shortfall to justify the tax increases. Senator Haynes, he's Assemblyman now, Haynes, says that the shortfall is closer to about $21 billion. What's the talk on the street up there?
Well, whether it's $21 billion or $35 billion, it's a monstrous deficit. And when we look at what could come down, I mean, the Democrats up here are proposing, taxing you more for your income, taxing you for what you do or buy, taxing you more for the car you drive, and the attacking attacks are upon us. Now, here's the good news. Even though the liberals are in charge and they want to ram more taxes down us and thus depress the economy and drive people out of state, the Republicans up here can actually stop most of these taxes. Most of the proposals would be for an actual tax increase, and that requires a two-thirds vote, and they won't get that unless some Republicans cave. So it's very important to realize that and support these guys who are fighting to stop these taxes.
All right, fine. Well, I think that's the encouraging thing, and that's why, even though certainly the Republicans are outnumbered almost 2-1, it's not completely 2-1, and they have to have 2-1 to get their programs through. So hopefully the Republicans will hang strong and, of course, prevent these increased taxes, which I don't think are necessary at all. I think that Governor Davis, what did he increase spending about 37% or something in his first 4 years? What he ought to do is cut back 37%, and we wouldn't have the deficit.
Yeah, just a cut back. I mean, I've had to cut back in my life when I have not had enough money for things. Gone down to one car at one time here and, you know, basically said, look, I can't just borrow. I mean, I remember I was in college. When I was in college, I had a roommate. We split the rent. My roommate was a little irresponsible, came home one day, said, look at this nice shiny phone I bought. All these gadgets, recording, everything. By the way, I think I'll be a little late on my half of the rent. Well, we had a nice sit-down and cut up his credit cards and prayed because he had to pay the rent first. He returned the phone. You know, this is a true story. You know, when we look at what's happening here, we have had an incredible ruinous thing here. Let me read to you a definition of liberal versus conservative. 200 years ago, a liberal was thought to be generous and broad-minded. However, as we know today, Dr. Stan, liberals want to take more money from hard-working families, and they pursue a very narrow-minded agenda that believes that big government is always superior to the strength of church, family, and individual responsibility. You know, we don't need a liberal solution. That's no solution. We have a problem because of the liberal mentality. We need a conservative solution. Now, Webster's defines conservative as one who or that which preserves from ruin, injury, etc., etc. And it's true. We need preservation from moral and financial ruin. Now, Dr. Stan, I've got a way for your listeners to get involved here. On our website, which is SaveCalifornia.com, we've got a way that you can actually send a message of no new taxes or fees to all the state legislators, there's 120 of them, and Gray Davis. You see, we have to stand against taxes and fees because the Senate Democrats up in Sacramento want to triple the car tax. And so we've got to stand against all these things. We have basically a one-button exercise. You write a little message, no new taxes and fees, push the button, and it'll be instantly sent to all the legislators and the governor. We've had hundreds of people using this system. It's a wonderful technological system that you can let your voice be heard. It's basically a way to, you know, it's a safe way to vent and make a difference at the same time.
All right, fine. It sounds like a great idea. You know, I think there's something I was really reading. It's a little almost ironic, but you know, in the past, why people have bought state bonds because you didn't have to pay, I think, either state or federal tax on them. But of course, with the new legislation that President Bush is advocating, why people are not going to have to pay income tax, either federal or state, on the dividends from their stocks, and so this will then tend to get people to invest more in stocks rather than in bonds, which will mean that the only way that California is going to be able to sell the $20 billion in bonds that the people foolishly voted for in the last election will be to actually raise the interest rates, which will cost billions and billions and more dollars. And nobody has ever thought about these things. Every time the government does something, why, of course, it creates more problems.
You know, there was a Boston Tea Party. We can have a Sacramento Tea Party. You know, after the election in November, people have the choice of give up or stay involved and grow forward. Now with these threats of new taxes and fees, that would really be several hundred dollars for the average family, at least, in additional expenses. I think we don't have a choice about whether to be involved or not. There's a lot of angry taxpayers with all these threats of taxes and so forth. And now is the time to get involved and let's turn the state around. You know, with the help of God and other people, we can really do it. Again, come to our website, SaveCalifornia.com, to send a free message to all the state legislators and the governor, no new taxes. We've had hundreds of people use this in just the first 24 hours of its release, and people are getting a release. They're getting a way to make a difference, and it's starting. So let's start the Sacramento Tea Party now.
Thanks very much, Randy. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay. And now we're going to go to Brad Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute, and you can find out what's happening. And, of course, I realize a lot of you are listening out across America, but remember what happens to California, the fifth largest economy in the world, is going to have an effect on your life. So let's see if we can get Herman to find Brad Dacus. No, I bet that's Brad right now. Hi, is this Brad?
Yes, it is.
Hi, well, tell us what's going on in the legal field.
Well, I tell you, we've been very, forthright in trying to work to go to bat for those who need assistance. And recently, I guess we've been dealing with the Sea Scouts. They've been have a real major struggle, and in particular, it's because the city of Berkeley refuses to allow them to have the occupancy of a facility they've been occupying under the same terms, because they refuse to compromise their own values and convictions with regards to homosexual scout leaders and members. So, and the membership issue. So it's a real struggle, and it's gone to the appellate court, and we've filed a brief there, and we've been asked to file a brief on their behalf now before the state Supreme Court, where it's now being appealed. And we're hopeful that the state Supreme Court will reverse the appellate court decision. And, if we were in Texas or some other part of the country, I'd be very confident. But I tell you, Dr. Stanley, it's we're not, California State Supreme Court is not the same as in other states, and it's, this is still going to be a tough battle.
Well, there's never been a country that has actually embraced homosexuality where that society or country has survived very long. And, one time we were a Christian country, and then we were an atheist country, and now we're a pagan country. And I think the people ought to begin to wonder, when is God going to take action against America? Maybe it's happening right now. God bless you for what you're doing. Anything else you want to tell our listeners about?
Well, no, it's just anyone ever needing assistance at all. We have a huge attorney network of attorneys, over 1,000, and who volunteer their time, and they should contact us at the Pacific Justice Institute if we can ever help them in any way.
And why don't you get your telephone number and your website out?
You bet. It's 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129, and our webpage is pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org, and tomorrow I'm scheduled tentatively to be on the O'Reilly Factor, so listeners can be not only watching but also praying. Hopefully we'll get truth out and to the masses.
Well, I think that you're in the big time now, getting on the O'Reilly Factor. Anyway, good luck to you. I know you'll do well. God bless you, Brad.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. That was Brad Dacus. And right now, of course, for the wrap-up program for this evening is really one of my favorite human beings. Her name is Edith Manchester. And I'm going to ask Herman if he'll put that on line 6 on the VIP line, because that way we can take calls. But Edith, I suppose I've known of Edith for close to 40 years. And Edith is sort of the leading activist and pro-life activist in the Santa Cruz half of the Monterey Bay. And she had some 12 children, and she came from a missionary family that was born and raised in China, and of course came back to the United States and became an atheist, and then of course returned to the Lord, and really has had a profound impact on many people's lives. And very often you'll see her out in front of the abortion clinic, just standing there with a sign or smiling at people. She's a wonderful person who's dedicated her life to doing God's work, and there's nobody I have more admiration for than Edith Manchester. Well, of course, she has gone to China recently. She's just recently returned from China. As I mentioned, she was born in China, and of course she... are you having a problem here? Can't get through? Let's have a little music, and we'll be right back here in just a moment to see if we can get Edith for you, because you really want to hear her. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and hopefully we'll have Edith with us in just a moment here. But, of course, Edith has just come back from China, and of course, she's going to tell us what's really going on over there. You know, we hear all sorts of reports about China. Apparently, there's just amazing economic growth there, and, of course, China is the country that is going to really destroy the economy of most of the rest of the world. Why do I say that? Because she can produce anything that we produce equally well and at a fraction of the cost. And, of course, people are going to buy China's products made with, in essence, slave labor that we have over there. The people, of course, work long hours, you know, for a few hours a day. Maybe the average person might make $100 a month and putting in very, very long hours, many, probably 5 or 6 days a week. Well, anyway, we're going to get all the facts from Edith. Hi, Edith. How are you tonight?
Well, hi, Stan. It's nice to hear your voice and be here.
Well, I'm sure glad you got back safe and sound from the Orient. Why don't you tell our listeners what you experienced when you were in China? Was this the China that you knew when you were growing up?
Oh, not at all. It has changed so much. And even knowing that it had changed when we got there, it was overwhelming. China is really making an effort, you know, to get the favor of the West and get the trade and everything.
Well, she's going to get all
modernize.
Right. Well, of course, but we're financing the whole thing. We put probably, the West has put $500 billion in there by now.
Uh-huh.
Of course, we are actually subsidizing our country, our own industries to go to China. And we're doing everything. We are building up, as I always say, the best enemy money can buy, because China will destroy the industries of the United States. We just cannot compete with them.
Yes, yes. I know I heard someone once say that who was concerned about a war between China and the U.S., and they said, no, they don't want that. They just want our money and our business. But we found it spiritually an overwhelming experience as we saw how the Chinese younger generation now has lost all faith in anything. And they're groping around for reality. And if we can, if the churches of the U.S. and other places can get in there and minister to them and bring the gospel, they'll find very open, receptive group of people.
Well, now, did you have a chance to meet with any of the home churches at all?
The one that we meet, that we took Bibles to, is the one in Canton that whose pastor is Samuel Lam. He's very famous because he refuses to register with the government, never has, and yet he has a huge church. And the Chinese are scared to antagonize the West by persecuting him, and so they let him have his church. And then when people come along and say that China is persecuting the house churches, they take them to Samuel Lam's church in Canton, which is now occupies two stories of a three-story building, and they say, see, we don't persecute them. Look at this church.
Well, of course, what's going on in the home churches other than Mr. Lam, Samuel Lam's church?
It's growing. There are... Chinese are accepting Christ, 20,000 people a day. We ran into Christians everywhere. It was amazing.
Now, how did you know that there were Christians? Could they speak English? Could they talk?
Yes.
To you, or what?
Yes, they could. We were surprised how much English is being taught in China. And anybody that has any contact with the West, whether it's in hotels or businesses, tour guides, taxi drivers, whatever, learns English. And we were able to speak quite well with them in English. The one exception was when we got we went to a church in Hong Kong. It's the Revival Christian Center, which is pastored by an American pastor and his wife, Dennis Balcom. And they have been there for many years, and their church is enormous. And they print and distribute Bibles. We got Bibles from them that were study Bibles, not little flat portions of scripture that you could tuck in your suitcase somewhere, but these were thick study Bibles, because they're finding that the house churches lack pastoral oversight and leadership. And so they're distributing these study Bibles to the pastors of the illegal churches. And as they get trained through reading this study Bible, they pass the information on to their congregations.
Well, now, why is the Chinese Communist government leaving the Americans there to minister and spread the gospel?
Why are they leaving?
Yes, why haven't
simply... Dennis Balcom is the only one. He's been in Hong Kong for years, and Hong Kong was British.
Oh, I see. But is he still in Hong Kong, or is he in...
He is still, and I found to my surprise, I thought when Hong Kong was turned over by the British to China, that it would become part of China, but it's not. And the British stipulated that if we turn Hong Kong over to you, you have to allow religious freedom, among certain other economic freedoms. And the Chinese government agreed. And they have kept their agreement so far. So this church is just on fire for the Lord.
Well, now, how then were you able to get the study Bibles from Hong Kong into China? Could you just take them in over the border?
No, this was a miracle. You have to, because Hong Kong is its own special district. It's called a special administrative district. It's different from the rest of China. And the Chinese people always say, that's why they say, Hong Kong and China. They consider Hong Kong separate, and it is in a way. So we got these study Bibles, three good-sized suitcases full of them, about 60 of them altogether. Then we had to get them through customs into Canton, which is in China proper, see? And we debated on how best to do this. Should we distribute them among all our suitcases and try to hide them? And finally we said, no, we're going to trust God. We're just going to take these three suitcases along, each of us with another suitcase, so that we would look like tourists, two suitcases apiece, and trust God to get us through customs. Well, we got the first. We were only six in our group. So three of them had the Bible suitcases, and three of us had just regular suitcases. They just waved five of us, including two of the suitcases, right through, never even looked. The sixth person was a woman who had a knapsack on her back and one of the Bible suitcases. They took her to one side to inspect her baggage, and we were all watching from a distance, trying not to seem too obvious to be what we were concerned about. And what to our surprise, he asked her to take off her knapsack. And he looked through it, and it was perfectly harmless, all her personal belongings. He never even looked at her blue suitcase. He just waved her right through. And we felt that was God.
Well, God does work in strange ways.
Yeah. So we got them all through customs without any problem. And then we took a train, went into Canton, and delivered them to Samuel Lam's house church there.
Well, now, of course, were some of the people you were with the people that you'd been with before? Or are these just...
No, I hadn't personally. Nora Lam did not lead this tour. I think as she's getting older, she's not leading as many tours. Or maybe there are more tours than she can handle. I'm not sure. But the leaders, their names were Bill and Ivy Bray, and they're from South Carolina. They work a lot with Nora Lam and help lead her tours.
All right, fine. And so, of course, you've got the Bibles on in there. Now,
yeah.
What is the house churches? Are the house churches being persecuted?
How?
Are the house churches being
persecuted?
Oh,
yes, they are. They are.
What are they doing to them?
Oh, they'll come and raid them and imprison them. Samuel Lam himself has been imprisoned twice in the past, the first time for 20 years. And he had, oh, maybe a dozen or two in his congregation when he went into prison. 20 years later, he comes out and finds his church has grown to 300. So then he was imprisoned again, and when he got, not for quite so long, when he got out, the church was still growing more. And he said, persecution is not stopping the church in China, because God does miracles for them, even when they're in prison. And they just let their light shine, and they're not afraid. They're not afraid of persecution. So they go on proclaiming the Lord, worshiping Him. God honors them for it.
And, of course, they have to meet in secret there because, of course, it's the the three-self church that they... The three-self church is the government church. But you were commenting that many people get saved in the government church and then they go to the house church. How does that work?
Yes, that works because the government church will allow only certain things to be preached. They will not allow the pastors to preach about the resurrection, for instance. Any of the really miraculous things about Jesus Christ, they won't allow it to be preached. They just want him presented as a fine teacher. So there's always, in the registered churches, there's always a government agent sitting in the congregation. And so the Christians, as they go on, as they get a hold of a Bible and a full Bible and read about it, they get dissatisfied with the registered church, and so they go and join an unregistered group somewhere.
Do we have any idea how many Christians there are in China today?
They didn't give us the figures.
I mean, I've heard 50 million, I've heard 80 million.
Yeah, but it is, if you think 20,000 a day, and it's been going on for several years, that is in the million.
Right.
But just how many, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody really knows. It was kind of laughable because when we came to Samuel Lamb's church, there was a policeman on guard across the street from the doorway to his church. And we noticed that policeman when we went in, when we went out. And asked Samuel Lamb about it, and he laughed. He said, yeah, they station one there all the time to keep an eye on us. But they don't dare touch us because Billy Graham, various presidents, Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and different presidents have visited us, and dignitaries and rulers from all the European countries. So they don't dare get rid of us.
So basically, of course, what they do then is they sort of use them to say, see, we're not harming anybody at all.
That's right.
But I wonder if the American dignitaries are taken in. The tragedy was when Billy Graham was over there, he came back and he sort of gave the impression there was no persecution of the church there. And the same thing was true when he went into Romania, as I remember. You know, there was no persecution of the church. So I don't know how he could be so blind as to believe that they would take him to the places where the persecution was taking place.
Well, I don't know either, Stan, but I do know, reading other articles, that that Billy Graham was taken in to some degree by Clinton, too. Thought he was kind of, I read an article. He praised him as a spiritual man.
Right. He said, I can forgive him. God can forgive him. I can forgive him. But God could not forgive Bill Clinton because he was never repentant.
That's right.
I think to say that Billy Graham could forgive him, only God can really forgive, and God only forgives with repentance. And there was certainly no evidence at all of repentance with William Jefferson Clinton. Well, of course, we're going to have to take a break here in just a minute. When we get back, of course, we'll invite your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening is Edith Manchester, and she's just back from Communist China over there. And of course, we want to get all the information we can. If there's anything you ever want to know about China, we're afraid to ask why this is the opportunity. So Edith will be with us for the next half hour. Our telephone number, 1-800-1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-2-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you do that simply by picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. Of course, when you join the Radio Liberty family, you get our four best tapes of the month. You get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you're helping us do what we do. And that is reach out all across America on a daily basis, at least 5 days a week, with the information you're not going to get from other sources. And so basically, we invite you to join the Radio Liberty family, or if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter to see what we're writing about, why, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a free copy of our December newsletter, which goes into the occult foundation of America's monetary supply. And you say, occult foundation? What are you talking about? Occult foundation? Well, that's what it is. You have to read to get the background of the information that we're able to put together from many, many sources. And we are so lucky to have access to the information we have, and certainly we want to share it with you and have you share it with others. So give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And if you haven't had a copy of our newsletter before, we'll be glad to send you a free copy. And we want you to, of course, copy our newsletters, get them in other people's hands. We want you to, of course, tell other people about our website at www.radioliberty.com, where people can listen on the Internet to our radio programs, pull down our archive programs, or simply link with our other networks that we're affiliated with, Genesis Network, American Freedom Network. And then please tell your friends about our radio program. If you have some of our audio tapes, feel free to copy them, or videotapes, or anything that we have actually produced. Please copy it and disseminate it, because that's how we're reaching people across America, one person at a time. And the great tragedy is the other side, of course, gets a whole generation, because they control the educational system. They control the media. They control the movies. They control the great foundations. They control, well, they control just about everything there. But, of course, all we have is a small group of people who believe in America, believe in our tradition of freedom. And hopefully we're on God's side. And I'd far rather be on our side than on their side any time. So, again, remember our number. If you'd like to give us a call, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America is under attack today. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Edith Manchester, just back from China, and we have with us on the line Nathan from Contra Costa. Nathan, how are you doing? Oh, let's push the right button there. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Good.
Okay, did you have a question for Edith?
Yes. Well, it's actually a comment, but I'd like her to respond to it. China right now is, I guess you could say, officially an atheist country, and they don't have a... since ancient times, have not had a heritage of believing in the monotheistic God, the one God, although I do believe they did in the ancient times. But my, in some sense at least, in my perspective, my understanding is that the Chinese are, biblically speaking, or considered scripturally to be the offspring of Shem, and that I've always felt that they have a special national destiny, that if they should choose God, if they should choose to be, to serve Hashem, to serve the Lord, that they would be, that there would be great spiritual blessings and great abundance in that nation. In your experience, well, I guess I'll go ahead and let you comment that on that off the air, if you wanted, the notion that they're the offspring of Shem, or that they have the blessing of Melchizedek, or that concept.
Yes, I agree, and I learned more about that on this trip. It was quite evident when we went and visited the Temple of Heaven in Beijing. And I read up a little bit on it and read about some of the on the, some of the signs that they had around.
Well, why don't you tell what you learned about it? Because, you know, of course, is there a, some sort of a tradition that one day China will become a major force for Christendom?
I don't know, but this trip has made me think it could be. What I did realize was its biblical roots that I never had thought carefully about before. The Temple of Heaven itself was amazing because, one thing, it's circular, no beginning and no end. It's in the roof is in three layers, the Trinity, and it has three sets of stairs going up to the altar. And the first, the middle set of stairs is reserved for God to use. Now that's quite amazing. If you just believe in a some kind of vague spirit, God doesn't need any stairs to go to the altar. Somewhere they had a latched onto the fact that God is more than just a vague, invisible spiritual influence. So they have this middle set of stairs that's for God's use. The right-hand side is for the emperor's use, and the left-hand side is for the highest officials to use. Then they also had a place where they burned some offerings. Burnt offerings that reminded you, and the offering of a calf was included in there, kind of reminiscent of the Old Testament.
The ancient the traditions of the children of Israel. Of
yes.
Course. Now, how long has this been around? How long has this temple been there?
Oh, it has been there since it was built in before B.C.
And before Christ was born there.
Yeah, and their traditions go back, they said in one of their materials, go back to about 3,000 B.C.,
All right, and you're talking now of the traditions of the temple or the traditions of the Chinese nation?
The traditions of the Chinese nation.
Right.
Go back to that far. The temple itself was built, I think they said the Qing Dynasty, which would be early A.D.s. But it was the outgrowth of a much earlier tradition. And if you study Chinese characters, I have a book on it, Studies in Genesis. You find that their early Chinese characters portray the early stories in Genesis.
Really?
The word for temptation is a garden with a tree in it. Their word for flood is a boat with eight people on it.
Isn't that fascinating?
Isn't that?
Well, of course, you know, every society has stories of the Great Flood. You know, it's been passed down from
mm-hmm.
generations, going
mm-hmm.
back to the Sumerians, and of course, I think even the Aztecs and the Incas talked about the Great Flood. So,
mm-hmm.
and certainly the Egyptians talked about it. Everybody knew there was a Great Flood.
Yeah.
Except, of course, modern-day scientists who are so much smarter than everybody else. But, you know, basically, antiquity certainly verifies, if you give it a chance to, the teachings of the Bible. And, of course, for so many years, of course, in the Holy Land, there was no record of Pontius Pilate until perhaps 20 years ago when they found a stone in Caesarea
yeah.
with Pilate's name on it. And now, of course, this new ossuary, whatever you call it, this new box with a name of the brother of Jesus, James, on it. So many of the things, in fact, we had the most fascinating program while you were away on the Shroud of Turin, but that's, we're getting a long way away from China.
Yeah.
Basically, of course, Christianity is growing there, whether it's 50 or 80 million Christians. 20,000 people a day would be approaching 7 million people a year would be becoming Christians. So over a period of 10 years, that's an awful lot of people.
Yes, it is. And when they really find Christ, they're on fire for him. We had one, I'd like to tell you about a couple of incidents I had in connection with witnessing for Christ.
Go right ahead.
We were in a jewelry store up in Beijing where they make their own jewelry. We visited it because you could watch them setting the jewels into rings and do all kinds of stuff. Very interesting. And I bought a couple of little pendants for a couple of grandchildren. Their parents had given me some money and asked if I could bring a present from China back to their two children. So I got two little pendants. One of them had the character for love, and the other had the character for double happiness. And as the clerk was wrapping them up and giving them to me, I said, "Do you know where real love and happiness come from?" He said, "No." And I said, "They come from Jesus Christ." And he was very interested. I talked to him a little bit about opening his heart to Jesus. And then I went back and told the rest of our group, who was another place in the store, about this interchange between me and the clerk. And one of our group had the four spiritual laws translated into Chinese and English. He gave it to me to give to this clerk. Well, the clerk, I couldn't find him, and it turns out he was in the back of the store, so they called him out, and interestingly enough, his name was, English name was John, good Bible name. They called him out, and by now the other clerks were interested, wondering what I wanted with this man again, afraid that something had gone wrong. So I handed him this tract and told him it would tell him how to find, how to give his life to Jesus and how Jesus loved him and died for him and all of that. And immediately some of the clerks began cheering, "Yes, yes." Turns out there were several Christians in the store. So, although I didn't feel that I should go any farther than that, I knew that those clerks could now explain further to him, answer his questions, and lead him to a real opening of his life to Jesus Christ. So that was great, and it just came out of a jewelry store. Well, when we went on to Tiananmen Square, where, as you know, that terrible massacre of the students who were demonstrating for democracy.
That's right, back in 1989.
Yes. And now they have a mausoleum for Mao Zedong there. And when you go through it, you cannot talk, you can't whisper, you can't make a sound, no pictures can be taken. You have to walk through in reverential silence. They elevate Mao Zedong practically to a god, I found, or the government is trying to at any rate. And maybe a lot of people regard him as just this wonderful savior of their nation. But whatever, when we were in the middle of that square, we met three young women who could speak English. So we started talking with them, and it turned out that two of them were Christians. The third one was not, and I happened to be walking with the third one. And so I asked her if she knew about Jesus, and she said, "Yes, I'm reading the Bible." And I said, "Well, the Bible is God's word, and you keep on reading it and open your heart and ask Jesus to come in." She said, "I'm going to do that." And so then I said, "Would you like to do it right now?" And she said, "Yes." So right in the middle of Tiananmen Square, I prayed with her, and she accepted Jesus as her Savior.
Edith, you're the only person I know in the world who could do something like that.
Well, when I told, and of course her two friends were jubilant, and when I told the rest of the group what had happened, our leader, Bill Bray, said, "You know, I think that's prophetic."
No, right, I think it is too, right in the middle of Tiananmen Square.
Yes, to have somebody accept Jesus. And that, Stan, it really is why I'm hopeful. I see that. We all sense that was a very significant conversion.
Well, of course, you know, the thing is that, Edith, that people try to, for instance, using political demonstrations to change the course of a nation. And, of course, Tiananmen Square was a total failure, you know, at least as far as having any, certainly historical significance, and it's sort of a rallying point for the Chinese people, but it's not going to change a nation. The only thing that will change a nation is Christianity.
That's right. And that's true here, too, in our nation.
Oh, especially in our nation.
Oh,
I think
oh.
that something terrible is going to have to happen before people begin turning back to the Lord. And even, in so many of our churches, really the gospel that's being preached, is a shallow, hollow gospel. I think that we're seeing the great apostasy that's described for the latter days. Certainly, society reflects the Christian church in America. And look at society today, and you have to ask, is Christianity a success or a failure? And I'd like to say that from our society's point of view, it's a failure. That doesn't mean Christianity has failed. It simply means, however, that our churches have failed.
Yeah, and they fail because they've gotten wimpy and too comfortable, to my mind. And I've been praying for a long time, Stan, that God would raise up some Daniels in this nation who would say, we don't care what the courts say, we don't care what the rulers say, we're going to pray. And they shouldn't just give in to the Supreme Court.
Well, I know.
When it comes
of course, you
to God himself.
Well, of course, you're one of those people who got arrested on the Supreme Court. Someday we'll have to have Edith tell us about one. But she got arrested for, and her crime was, of course, praying on the stairs of the Supreme Court.
That's right. And I tell people here, it's nothing to go to jail in this country. The jails are comfortable.
Right.
But it is something to go to jail in China.
Right. Well, of course, I'm sure if you were over there, why you'd be leading the whole campaign. Right now, we've got to go to Herman here. I guess we lost Herman.
Oh.
Herman, you're going to have to try him once more. Herman, are you there? No, Herman, you're going to have to use one line and call another line. So call from line 2 to line 1, and then you can get through. And that's the only way that it'll work. And then, of course, you'll have to screen line 2 over to line 1. I'm just talking to Herman is our producer this evening. And,
oh.
And he wants so much to talk to you.
Oh.
So anyway, now, of course, as far as the prosperity, of course, somebody recently had said that, of course, prosperity will destroy Christianity in China. That we've only maybe got another 10 years or so before the Chinese people become a prosperous, and then, of course, they become affluent, and then they become indifferent. And really, Christianity grows and prospers under persecution. And affluence, of course, is a terrible curse because people forget what's really important.
Yes, and yet God has promises, saying, I'll prosper you. But everybody interprets that as meaning, well, you're going to get a lot of money and lead a affluent life. I don't think that's real prosperity in God's eyes at all.
I think
it's the inner prosperity that counts.
I agree with you totally. Well, of course, you talked to a lot of Christian people over there. You saw that. Are people still riding predominantly the bicycles, or is the automobile beginning to have an impact in China today?
Well, the automobile is having an impact, but there are huge numbers of bicycles still. And for the ordinary people that around in their neighborhoods, I visited a university campus that used to be a missionary university when I was growing up, St. John's University in Shanghai, and it's now a government university of business and law. And the students were on bicycles everywhere, all around.
Right. Now, does everybody wear the same sort of drab little uniforms, or have they gotten away from that?
No, they've gotten away from that, but everybody wears Western dress. I didn't see anybody in traditional Chinese clothing.
Now, did you get at all in the countryside, in the farming areas at all?
No, we didn't. And I'm sure we would have seen more traditional clothing there. We were just in the cities, because that's where the business of our trip was taking place. And so I'm sorry we didn't get into the countryside, because I do think it would have been different.
Well, I'm sure it'd be entirely different. In fact, many of the areas in the countryside, very little has changed in hundreds and hundreds of years or thousands of years.
Yeah.
But of course, more and more people are going to into the cities because this is where the jobs are. This is the opportunity. It's a very hard life out in the countryside.
Yes, yes, I know. It's interesting that there was a headline in the Chinese paper well, I mean, the English edition of it, when we were there, about STEM, about using stem cells in surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a different, but I was surprised to see it. And they said in Hong Kong, there has been the first successful stem cell surgeries in the world.
Well,
they
but
said,
what do you mean stem cell surgery? Stem cells are simply cells that you get from either a fetus or you get it from the umbilical cord blood, and then you grow these cells because the stem cell has a pluripotential. In other words, it has the capacity to form a muscle or a nerve or even a heart.
But in this, but see, in this country, they started using the embryos, you know, of aborted babies, frozen embryos,
right,
and that kind of thing. But this article said specifically, these were stem cells from the patient's own body.
Okay, well, you can actually do that as well.
And it said that the other kind is using the embryos is dangerous. They've had uncertain results, but from your own body is fine. And I thought, oh, I wish I'd see a headline article like that in this country.
Well, now, did you hear of many miracles among the believers for healing miracles, things of that sort?
I did more on my last trip where we had more chance to visit, for instance, in Samuel Lamb's church. Yes, there's, and three Christians from house churches came and visited us in our hotel and told amazing miracles. For instance, the jailers came and said to a Christian woman, you say that your Jesus can raise people from the dead? So they brought in a dead person and locked her up in a room with the person who had just died and said, well, you're going to stay locked up there until your Jesus raises this person from the dead. Well, this woman prayed for 2 days, and on the third day, God raised the person from the dead. And she banged on her door and told them, they unlocked it and let her out, and the living person.
Well, you know, God can work in very, very strange ways, and we have a wonderful tape that says it's called, we call it the Devil's Heartbeat. But the second one is, a story of Reverend Mellon, what happened when he was a prisoner there in the Chinese prisons following the Second World War, and some of the miraculous things that happened to him, and how, even through his suffering, it had such a profound impact upon his jailers, some of whom actually gave their lives for the Lord who they had accepted.
So God's the same as he was in the Bible, and he'll do the same things if needed, not just for our convenience, but I tell you, when you're on the spot, God comes through.
No, I know he does, and I think we've seen his impact in your life and my life and the life of other believers, but you have to really believe, and it's amazing how he can touch people's lives. And really, I think it's one of the most exciting things in the world today, what is taking place in communist China. And of course, we are building up the economy of China for specific geopolitical purposes. And of course, our leaders have an agenda. They want a new world order, a new world religion.
Yes.
But God has an agenda, too. And eventually, of course, his agenda is going to be sort of like playing cards, and God will trump the devil. But right now, of course, it appears the devil's doing pretty well.
Yeah, well, it really struck me on this trip. The national animal emblem for China is the dragon. And their national color is red.
Right.
And I, while on the trip, I turned to Revelation, the 12th, 13th, 14th chapter on there, where it speaks about the great red dragon. And the Chinese believe that the dragon is a friendly beast. Sometimes they portray him. I saw paintings and sculptures of it smiling. They think he's friendly. And I said, they don't realize that their country is in the grip of a very wicked being, and that is Satan himself, the great red dragon. And it was everywhere. And so growing up with that, You know, they just sort of accept all this demonic stuff. But then, when they're under, when they get in touch with the gospel, they find a reality. And the great red dragon is not going to prevail.
Well, what lesson does the Chinese church have for us today, would you say?
I would say that the great lesson is that total surrender of your life to Jesus, let go of anything that would interfere with that, and get your eyes off of material prosperity and onto spiritual prosperity. God will prosper us spiritually. He doesn't mind blessing us with material things if he can trust us to use them right. But the main thing is to totally turn your life over to Jesus, because he will do anything. He's capable, he's well able to do anything in your life, and you let him have his way in your life, and you'll never regret it.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Edith. It's always a pleasure having you, and I'm just glad you got back safe and sound. And I think that what's happening in China is going to have a profound impact on what's going on in America today.
Yes. I agree, very much so.
I mean, I think that their economic situation is going to really end up in the transfer of the wealth of America to them, because we're going to be buying their products. And basically, you know, as more and more of our factories have to shut down because we can't compete with what's happening in China, God is going to use that, I hope, to educate or perhaps to turn the people in America back towards him. And then, of course, I think the phenomenal growth of the church in China is going to have a profound impact on Lucifer's plan, and certainly God will use that for his glory. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Dan. Bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, I hope you enjoyed our program with Edith Manchester this evening. Edith is one of the sweetest, most wonderful people I know, and I value her friendship very, very much. So, well, this is the time, of course, when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty looks to you for your support. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, and we ask you to pray for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because, you know, just as religion is revival is sweeping throughout China, America is never going to be turned around unless there's revival in America. Will it happen? I don't know whether it's going to happen or not, but we should pray for it and ask for it, because, of course, we're not going to save America. Only God can save America. And then, of course, we ask you to remember our ministry, Radio Liberty. We ask you to pray for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you, this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Universalist minister.
Well, because I didn't know where he really stood as far as Christianity is concerned, because a lot of these people really don't believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. They believe in Christian teaching, but not in the reality of Christianity. But we, you know, we didn't get into that. We talked about